Aisha, and I'm a former host of Mocha Single Mothers by Choice, or SMCs. Like you, as an SMC, I decided to become a mother knowing I'd be the sole care provider and parent for my children, at least at the outset. The Mocha stood for Black, so I'm using the word Black, and I'll be discussing being a single mother by choice from a Black woman's lens. You'll connect with all the interesting and fun things about this non-traditional path, like discussing which sperm to use and some hard truths about fertility and the realities of dating as a single mother who doesn't have a co-parent to rely on occasionally, and what it's actually like to parent as an S&C. This is the Black Single Mothers by Choice podcast. A few weeks ago, we did the twins episode when we were talking about SMCs having twins. And when I listened to the twin episode, my mind was just blown anew because there were so many big topics that were hit on in that episode. And I felt that we needed to take a step back and debrief that episode thoroughly. Mm-hmm. Pregnancy is a blur. And these are people in our community. These are my friends. So we talk to them through their pregnancy, but when you actually get an opportunity to hone in on the finer details, it's just wow, because pregnancy is such a blur, but it is just wow. So why don't we go through and break down some of the medical aspects of a twin pregnancy that Toja and Carla brought up last week that kind of overlapped with my experiences. So my first pregnancy with my oldest was bliss. No complications. It was just bliss. My second pregnancy, I think I've mentioned before, was a shit show in that things just kind of went wrong in terms of medical complications. And so one of the things I think Carla and Toja hit on was gestational diabetes. I was being monitored throughout my entire pregnancy for gestational diabetes for if I tip into it. So I was at risk for having gestational diabetes. And so I did not go into gestational diabetes until the 34th week of my pregnancy, but I was monitoring myself the entire pregnancy. I had to, the needle pricks, I was on medication. I had to really whittle down and watch what I ate throughout my pregnancy.
Which I cannot even imagine, because like when you're pregnant, you have these cravings and all I wanted was chocolate cake. Literally, I could have eaten chocolate cake for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, which is probably why I gained so much weight. But I cannot imagine having to be like, okay, I guess I'm eating green beans and drinking a smoothie.
It was a mess because I also had morning sickness, which I did not have with my first pregnancy. And when you have an empty stomach, you have to eat a lot. I had to eat a lot in order to overcome morning sickness. Mm-hmm. Normally, what I would want to eat are carbs. I could not eat carbs. So it was, how do you fill up your belly on vegetables and rabbit food and eggs, right?
Well, and that's interesting because I'm thinking back to what I would eat when I was feeling sick, and it was like crackers or bread.
Or bagels. Look, and so that was gestational diabetes. That was in and of itself a lot to deal with during pregnancy. Now, toward the end of my pregnancy, around 34 weeks, they noticed that the baby was not growing as big as they expected at that gestational age. And so my OB was like, let's wait and see what the next appointment brings, which was my 36-week appointment. At my 36-week appointment, they diagnosed me with IUGR, which is intrauterine growth restriction. I had enough. It was a 3-year journey to even get to that far. I was mentally done. My medical team knew that I was mentally done, and they were just doing whatever they needed to do to keep me sane throughout this last stretch of pregnancy. So I thoroughly appreciated them. They knew where I was. I was like, I can't handle something going wrong. And they told me, let us worry about that. When there's something to worry about, we'll let you know. So for the 2 weeks, I didn't really think about it. I trusted my medical team because I just wanted my take-home baby. I didn't care about the details in between. I just wanted my baby. And I let them know. I said, at the end of this, I have a 5-year-old who I need to go home to, and we need a baby to take home with us. So we can't have this. We can't have a situation where I don't take home a baby. So intrauterine growth restriction means that the baby is not growing as well as expected. Mm-hmm. And so what that meant with that diagnosis is a cascade of happenings that come along with that. I was told I had to increase my calories because with intrauterine growth restriction, is the baby getting enough calories? So yeah. I had to increase my calories. And so I'm sitting there, but I'm monitoring my diet for gestational diabetes. How do I increase calories eating only vegetable protein? And so they were like, you have to start drinking protein shakes. What I had to drink Glucerna, 3 Glucernas a day, because I think that they were something like 500 calories each on top of my regular diet. And so this was a low sugar protein shake, which was joy. So I had to really manage that while still going to work, while still caring for my 4.5-year-old and preparing her foods. And then part of managing the gestational diabetes is making sure that you exercise, right? Because that helps to manage your insulin levels. Having to conserve calories meant I could not exercise. It meant I could not pick up my toddler. It meant as an SMC, I could not nest and prepare my home for the baby because all of that required energy. It meant I could not go and play with my child for the last 4 weeks of pregnancy. It also meant that I had to go on bed rest. Oh. And so I had to involve my job and I had to call them and say, hey, I need to be put on bed rest because I need to conserve my energy. And going into the office was an energy expenditure that I could not afford at that time.
And stuff for your that,
I just had to. That was me balancing the risk. I tried to limit all other energy expenditure, but I still, as an SNC, had to go pick up and drop off my child. But also, so during that time period, that meant, let's talk a little bit, the number of appointments that added to my schedule. That's where I'm going to leave intrauterine growth restriction. So the way to fix that is early term delivery, or you're being monitored very closely. And one of the outcomes of intrauterine growth restriction is hypoxia, not getting enough oxygen, not getting enough blood. So when they're doing the Doppler and they're doing the ultrasounds, they're looking for organ saving patterns. Like the fetus is struggling enough that they're trying to save the heart and the brain. And so then that causes a real shrinking of the rest of the body of the baby. And so that's what they're looking for, but they typically will deliver early so that nothing happens to the baby. And so what my OB was telling me was when this is happening, you want to do kick counts. You want to make sure that you feel the baby move. Mm-hmm. And I had an anterior placenta, so I was not feeling a whole lot of movement, period, throughout the entire pregnancy. So it was a lot of anxiety. And the way that I managed it was I just tried to keep my support team looped in. And I tried to stay optimistic and I was just open with everybody that I spoke to and just tried to focus on getting to the last weeks of pregnancy. So another impact is the impact to your job. So both Toja and Carla had twin pregnancies and sometimes it requires an extended period of bed rest. And on top of that, you have a lot of doctor's appointments. For me and my situation, in particular with my second pregnancy, because I was being monitored from the very beginning for gestational diabetes, that meant that I had an appointment with an endocrinologist probably twice a month on top of your regular OB appointments. Mm-hmm. And then when I moved into intrauterine growth restriction, I also had to have weekly maternal fetal monitoring appointments, MFM appointments, which meant the MFM appointment is not just an appointment where you go, they check you out, and then you leave. Most of the times it's at a hospital. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I had to wait until the baby flipped over. I had to wait to increase the heart rate. Mm-hmm. And so my little baby wanted to sleep a lot. So these ended up being 3-hour appointments because I had to get the baby to move. So they would have to give me a snack, cookies and juice, to get the baby to wake up and move. And then if she didn't, I had to turn to the next side. Then they had to reset all the monitors. It was like a 3-hour appointment once or twice a week. But you're like laying on a bed, hooked up to monitors and eating, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm eating snacks, which spike in blood sugar, right? Juice and all that stuff. So it was just, it was a lot. It ended up being really intense. And then when you have a second child, already at home, you have their appointments, their sick appointments, your health maintenance appointments. So it is a lot to juggle and it becomes really intense at times. So it could impact your job. I can tell you each time I went through an IVF treatment, my mood was impacted. So you would be sometimes out of control and at work. And if you're managing people, you're working double time to manage your moods because you don't want to snap at somebody because you're pregnant or you're on hormones. All right, let's talk a little bit about the finances, right? Because with twins and a twin pregnancy, and I love the way Toja framed this in that she wasn't looking at it as like paying double for everything, but it from a singleton looking in, for me, that's what freaked me out was that it would be double of everything at that point. And I like the way Toja again explained this, where she was like, it's a strategy because there's month to month, it's a strategy. And I'm currently going through because the world, the economy doesn't stand still when you have twins, right? And so when you're paying childcare, inflation impacts childcare, everything starts to impact that childcare. And so you have to have a strategy. Now, childcare lasts but like 3 to 5 years if you're a parent, because some states have mandatory preschool or something like that, free preschool. I'm in Virginia, we don't have that. So I am on board for paying until my child enters kindergarten. And so I absolutely have a strategy for paying for childcare. Luckily, I'm at a childcare center that allows me to put daycare on a credit card, and it's a cashback rewards credit card. So I do get to reap some benefit of the money that I'm spending out, but I go into the red each month because of childcare. And I'm just looking, I don't want to rush my child into growing into five, but I'm also looking for the light at the end of the tunnel when she enters elementary school. And once you become pregnant and you're confident in that pregnancy, start looking for all of the things that require lottery, because oftentimes by the time that baby is here, you would have missed the lottery. I did want to take a step back and talk about something that was implied in Carla's story when she was talking, because we had talked through all the way up until she transferred her embryos about, do you transfer one? Do you transfer two? And I really deeply appreciate Carla's thought process and why she made the decision to transfer two as opposed to one. And I think key to that was that she did not want to have remaining embryos. And so she transferred the two, understanding that there was a strong chance of twins. But she, because many who do IVF will have remaining embryos, and then you are trying to figure out, what do I do with these embryos? And so she made the decision to transfer two, but having to decide what to do with embryos is a very real thing. And so when you use double donor, that means you are the parent, but you also have the biological or the other parts of the DNA, right? That contributes to your child. There is the male part. So someone that you would have to interact with ideally in the future, your kid too. And then there's the egg donor part, the person who donated the egg, the male who donated the sperm, and then it's the female who donated the egg. So all of that gets wrapped up into, and once you have donated embryos, then it's another set of family members, right? And it's the SMC who used that embryo, or the parents who ended up adopting that embryo. So it becomes a lot more complex to tell that conception story. And as we say, a lot of times SMCs are thinking people. So we're not just thinking about the today and for us to carry this pregnancy, right? We're also thinking about how our decisions will impact our children down the line. I was shocked, just the imagery of Toja telling the story of having open wounds where I have the luxury of stretch marks. She had open slashes, gashes that had to themselves heal from the pregnancy. I can't imagine I'm a runner too. And so when Toja talked about being a runner, I am mentally impacted by not being able to work out as often as I did prior to becoming a mom. Now I'm like almost four years in, and I feel almost normal. Like I can go out and run if I want to, but I can't imagine not being able to do the things that I would normally do prior to having to carry a pregnancy. And so I do appreciate her candor in sharing that part of her story. And let's talk about epidural for a hot second, because you're in the middle of contractions when they have to come in and give you an epidural. So remember, you're close to delivery. So your contractions are like 1 to 2 minutes apart. And so it doesn't take them 1 to 2 minutes to put in a catheter. So I remember getting that. And I carried a smaller pregnancy. And so they came in to do the epidural and I'm in the middle of a contraction and they're like, hold still. You hold still. Look, that was my experience with my first pregnancy. It was bliss. As soon as I walked in, I had 2 contractions and I was done. They were like, do you want the, I was like, yep, give it to me. The second time.
Even before the contractions start, experience the contractions.
They had asked me as soon as I got there and I was like, no, I'm gonna ride it out. I had 2 contractions. I was like, oh no, give me the drugs. But with my second pregnancy, I was induced. This is a pro tip that a friend of mine told me, is that as soon as you get there and chit-chatting with the nurses, ask how many people are in active labor on your floor. Mm. That gives you an indication of how available the anesthesiologist is going to be when you're ready. So I got there for my second pregnancy, and this one I was intent on doing full out labor, no epidural. So by the time I was ready for meds, I was like, I'm ready for the drugs. The anesthesiologist is doing a C-section. I was like, but I'm ready for the drugs now. I couldn't take it. I had to wait probably an hour in active labor for the anesthesiologist to get done. Because I will say, your journey to labor and delivery is yours. We won't judge you if you decide to go full out natural. We won't judge you if you decide to get the epidural. But alas, that is our debrief of the twin episode. We just wanted to hit on some of the finer points, because I think sometimes when you go through it and then you're still in the midst of that fourth trimester, it's just, you made it through. So everything is just, you're just retelling that story. But there are so many nuances to both of their stories that we really thought that it warranted a debrief episode. Full Pod, thank you so much for taking the time to listen. If you like what you've heard, please share this podcast with your girlfriends. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about the topics covered in this episode. So email me at mochasnc@gmail.com. If you found value in the topics covered, consider making a donation using the link in the show notes below. Till next time, Pod. Bye now.